a tabletop role-playing podcast with the die decides our topic. I am Dylan.
I'm Jenny.
And today we will be talking about the importance of doing your goddamn research. Do it.
Research.
God dang it. It's important. Research first should be defined, for we do not mean that you need to go and memorize every little detail. If you're playing a pre-made, make sure you at least glance over every chapter. Make sure you know what's going to be happening, and make sure you know the pertinent information. Famously, I've talked about this many times on this podcast, wherein we had a GM who did not read ahead, did not know that we were in fact supposed to go to a giant for help, and when we went to said giant for help, he smashed us, and we ended up all dying. It was a TPK because he didn't read ahead and didn't know that that giant was supposed to come in and save us instead of clobbering our noggins in. And we're all a little salty about that still.
I feel so bad for you guys, but I can't help but chuckle at the same time, because it does sound like a mistake I would make.
If it's not a pre-made, have an idea of what you're going to do. And really, the most important thing you're going to look for as a GM is your stat blocks. And it's not like you need to memorize all the stat blocks. You need to know exactly what every single monster does, when and how and why. It's really just important that you know what monsters you're going to place and what amounts, and that you have those stat blocks somewhere handy so that they're very quick reference for you. That's really the big number one takeaway, is that anything you're going to use that requires a specific mechanic, whether it be a monster, whether it be a trap, whether it's going to be like some sort of environmental thing you're doing, even if it's something you made yourself, make sure you've got the notes for that handy, so when the time comes to use that thing, you're not going to be bogging everything down by, oh, hold on, let me look this up. Oh, where was it? Where did I put that? Oh, let me Google this. Make sure you know what you're doing. And if you don't know exactly what you're doing off the top of your head, make sure that the information on how to do that is readily available so that you can figure out what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole monster thing is still something I'm having trouble with, because I'm still new, so I look at monsters and I'm like, hey, I think the players will be able to handle this. I put it in and then I'm like, oh, the challenge rating on this thing is 9. Oops.
Yeah, CR is an important thing to take into consideration when putting monsters. Like, it's not even necessarily bad to put a high CR monster up against a group, but that's got to be like a boss fight level thing. It's going to be something that you're doing whenever the group has had some time to recuperate and whenever they're going to go in with, you know, both barrels loaded. So at least they've got a fighting chance. You don't want to just stomp them into the ground. That's not fun for anyone.
Well,
unless you're an asshole.
The mistake I keep running into is I won't look at that and then I'll be like, oh, and I can add these other tiny things with it too, because, you know, then it'll be a challenge for them. And then I plug it into this challenge rating thing that one of my players gave me, and it'll say, this is a deadly encounter. And I'm like, oh, it's too late, but uh-oh.
Yeah, challenge rating calculators are very helpful, especially if you are new. It's worth it, even like this is a good topic to research, is knowing how challenge rating works, because challenge rating is meant like if you are a CR9 creature, and this is kind of universal to both Pathfinder and D&D, but if it's a CR9 creature, it expects that you've got at least 4 people in the group at level 9 to be able to handle that creature effectively. That will just be like a normal encounter. Adding more of those things will make it slightly more challenging. Whenever you start increasing the challenge rating from your player's level, that's whenever you start getting harder and harder encounters. I mean, to tone down a little bit.
Yeah. When I make that mistake, I tend to cut the HP a bit, cut the attack a little bit. And if they start beating it too easily, I'll put the attack back to normal, but leave the HP alone.
Yeah. And that's another, that's a good thing. That's a good point that you bring up. Because like, if you do have something like you want to use in it, and you've looked into it and you see that it is too high level, you see that it's a little bit too tough, and you know that you really want to use this particular monster, then you can figure out, you know, dampening it down a little bit and putting it down on the level of your players. That's, again, something that you have to make sure that you've done the research for so that you know that it's appropriately leveled to your group. Like, I actually made this mistake fairly recently. I didn't know that between 3.5 and Pathfinder First Edition, there's actually a significant difference in the way challenge rating is calculated. So a creature that should have been like a moderate challenge for my group that I pulled out of a 3.5 book, I didn't realize actually had some stuff that was doing just insane numbers because they lowered just kind of the general numbers of damage and stuff from 3.5 to Pathfinder. So this thing was doing like just incredibly high damage every single turn because it would do these big pulses of energy that I figured my group would be able to, you know, get the saves to half it just about every time, but they didn't. They started actually getting smashed, and I had to take away some of that creature's abilities to make that giant, you know, negative energy pulse kind of the big threat to make sure that they burned it down quickly while taking away its other things that would have made it just an entirely impossible encounter.
Yeah, like I'm grateful that my players are pretty cool about this. I mean, Dylan's one of my players. They're pretty cool about it, and they're like, no, it's okay. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry.
Especially with like new GMs and stuff, like it's hard to kind of figure out in the very beginning what exactly you're going to need to know off the top of your head and what can just kind of be like within arm's reach. It takes a little bit of finagling. So in that way, GMing is kind of like an art form. You really got to kind of like figure out your group and how they want to play the game and then figure out how to build the game around that. And that in itself can be like a whole topic of study. Like tabletop games are such a psychological affair. It's insane.
They are.
And research isn't even just important for the GMs. Well, the GMs certainly do have a lot on their plate. There have been a lot of things over these past years that have made a lot of that so much easier. Like, a lot of these things are being put up available in, like, PDF format where you don't even have to have a physical book anymore. You can, like, you know, control F, search through a document, find exactly what you need on the quick. You've got these tabletop tools like Roll20 and Foundry that can have compendiums of this information built into them so that as long as you take a look at the stat blocks beforehand and make sure everything's in order and that you know what you're going to be using for a given thing, you can just pull a monster directly out of it, slap it on the table, and it's ready to go. You don't even really have to do a whole lot to set it up. It's just there. So you've got like these massive databanks of information just ready to go for things like Pathfinder and D&D. It's all just there and ready to go.
Which I do like. I definitely like that it's much easier to do that now because I tried one thing of GMing that I don't really even count because it was a friend's homebrew system and it was very GM heavy. Everything from the player abilities up, like, it was all GM done. The GM decided what ability you had. The GM decided everything.
See, that I think puts a bit too much on the Game Master's plate. Like, the Game Master already has a little bit more to do in a given game than any player does. Like, players certainly do have to do their own research, and we'll get to that as well. But a GM doesn't just control one character and what happens with the one character. They have to know about the enemies that are going to be placed. They have to know about the cities that you're going to go to. It's generally a rule of thumb that unless it's like everybody's first time playing or you know that it's going to be like a new GM or whatever, like the GM should really have a solid grasp on how a system works before trying to run it because everyone's going to be looking to them for guidance. The GM is generally seen as the person who knows how to play the game and therefore is who everyone gets that information out of. And especially in things like homebrew systems, where if it's not you who made it, that gets incredibly difficult to pull off just because you're having to learn everything at the exact same time as everyone else. And that's a lot of stress. If you've already got, you know, you have to make the world, you have to place the enemies, you have to write the story, You have to make these NPCs. If you also have to learn the system at the exact same time that everyone else is doing it, while everyone is looking to you for guidance and to make these calls of judgment on whether or not a rule applies here or what skill is appropriate to a certain situation, that's a lot being placed on a single person.
Oh, yeah. And of course, when the two of the players don't even want to play, it makes it so much difficult. But that's a tangent.
If they don't want to play, then why are they even there?
I don't know. They just didn't want to interact with the NPCs. They didn't want to try and do the point of the game, which I told everybody, look, this is my first time. The point of this is to escape. It's an escape the room game, basically, but it was a facility. And they didn't want to.
Then they shouldn't be wasting everyone else's time.
Yeah.
But
so I quit. But anyway.
Yeah, I just don't stick around. That group sounded a little toxic. Anywazzle, as I also stated before, it is not only important for a GM to do their research. While they definitely do have a little bit more on their plate, especially if you're one of those GMs who does like to plan out everything in advance. That's not the kind of GM I am, but we can talk about that another time. They've already got a lot on their plate. They have to know what monsters are going to be using and at least have the stat blocks available. They have to know. Apologies for all the jingling. I've got a bunch of new cat toys and they're playing with them. But the GMs have to already put so much on their own plate to be able to keep up with everything that the players are going to be doing. And especially given that a GM cannot plan for every eventuality, players will figure out how to break anything you put together. I guarantee.
Yes, they will.
So there's a lot of improv that has to go into that kind of stuff as well. So that's why I tend to be a little bit loosey-goosey with that stuff, to kind of leave myself a little wiggle room. But players also kind of have to know what they're doing. They have to look at what the specific character they want to be is, what they intend to be good at, and how they get to that point. And like whether it's worth it to sacrifice one stat or one skill to be able to continually improve another one, or if they want to keep themselves a little bit more even across the board, what's going to be more important. I've got a player in my current campaign who is playing a fairy samurai named Cinnamon Whifflestone. Cinnamon is one of the most devastatingly powerful characters I have ever seen in close quarters combat, and Cinnamon will die the moment anything hits her. Cinnamon is like two steps away from a stat death at any moment, because I think both her intelligence and her wisdom are at like 4 or 6 or something just incredibly low, to the point where like if a mind flayer came in and decided Cinnamon needs to fuck off, they could kill her in seconds if they really wanted to.
Oh wow.
And that's a decision he had to make. He had to look into what are the advantages of playing a fairy samurai. Would another race be better? Is it worth it to be able to get these certain stat bonuses? Because a fairy samurai is honestly a very interesting combination in that they have such a huge dex bonus for being a very, very small thing. Very tiny creature. And it means that they have to pass acrobatics checks because they can't even attack from adjacent squares. This fairy has to occupy the same square as an enemy to be able to attack them, and that automatically provokes an attack of opportunity that they have to do acrobatics checks to be able to mitigate. He figured out exactly what he wanted to do with his character, and he went down a bit of a rabbit hole to figure out how to make that happen, what were the pros and cons of doing this, and whether or not he actually wanted to do it. And he decided to go with that. And you may not necessarily have to go down all that much of a rabbit hole. You can just decide, I want to be a paladin. What are some good magic items and what are some good stats for being a paladin? And you can just kind of roll from there. And again, let everything be more loosey-goosey. But if you want a specific build and you want to accomplish a specific thing, you're going to have to look into what class would be most appropriate for that? What race would be most appropriate for that? Would I be better off using a different class archetype? Would I be better off using a different racial trait that I could sub out for another one? There's a whole level of intensity that building a character can get to, and it's up to you to decide if you want to get that level of intensity. But once you've decided that you know what you want your character to be, you got to figure out getting there. And that's just as important as anything a GM can do.
I never even thought of that. I'll be honest, I never even thought of that. Because I'm more of the second type of player you mentioned. What stat should I do? What are the magic items? What's the class? Boom, I'm done.
That's honestly perfectly fine. Like, if that's the way you want to do it, if you want to leave that freedom to your character's development as they develop, that's a perfectly valid way to do things. That's up until I learned about the Soul Drinker archetype, prestige class. Up until I learned about that, Ateowin was just like, his whole idea was necromancer. That was it. I didn't really have anything past that. He was a wizard, he was a necromancer. But then once I saw Soul Drinker, I was like, oh, now I need to figure out how I'm going to get there. And then I got to figure out doing that. And that became the point in which I decided, now I have to have this set path that Ateowin has to follow. And these are the steps I have to take to get there. And these are the things that are going to make that work.
I'm sad that that sort of thing doesn't exist for D&D, because I would love to see how that works for Ateowin.
They might get there. Like, D&D 5e has slowly been expanding its borders over the years. I still think it is very basic in comparison to a lot of other RPGs. And we've talked about that in the past as well. That's got its own pros and cons.
Yeah.
But it's kind of getting there.
Which is good.
So we've talked about GMs needing to do their research. Talked about players needing to do their research. What do you think is the most important thing for both of them to research, Jenny?
The system. Like,
exactly.
What the system is in general.
How to play the god dang game. It is so important to know this part, because this is the thing that's going to bog everyone down if even a single person doesn't know what they're doing. Because once it gets to your turn, if you're not sure how to play the game at all, everyone has to stop and figure out what's going on. So this can honestly be one of the most daunting things for a person getting into tabletop. And I understand it. These games, there's like dice and there's numbers and there's these sheets, and you got to look at like races and classes, and you got to kind of like know the background of the world this game is going to take place in. Is it something that's already in a book, or is it something my GM's making up for himself? It can be daunting for first time players, especially to figure out, what is this game and how do I play it?
Especially when Pathfinder's the very first game you're playing and nobody will tell you how to make a character.
Pathfinder is complex. And it's funny because like Pathfinder started off not that bad, but it just went for so long that so much extra content got added, and more content, more content, more content, that it's honestly one of the biggest and most flexible systems that you could possibly play in. But as a result, if you do fall down that rabbit hole, you could be there for a while figuring out what it is you want to do.
Oh, that was terrible. I was the player where battle would come around and I'd be like, wait, hold on. What's that for? And then
a lot of people, when they hear the word research, they think like, oh, well, I got to go look this up. I got to have the book. I got to go find the website and all that. It's like, you don't have to do it that way. Research is you learning what you need to learn in any way that suits you best. And oftentimes, whenever you are a new player, the easiest way to learn how to play is going to be to have somebody sit down with you. And if you don't want to slow the game down on day of, it's totally acceptable, at least if your GM's not an asshole, to sit down with the GM or sit down with another player and say, hey, I want to figure out how to play before we get started. Can we like maybe run a scenario or something? Can you show me the ins and outs of playing this game? Because even on the podcast where I've talked about like the main mechanics of several games at this point, you probably are only really getting the basic gist of anything. You don't know how to play simply by listening to somebody. You can kind of figure things out. You can get the basics by reading the entire rule book, but it really comes, just like anything else, with practice.
Right. Like, someday I would like to have somebody do a teaching game with me or something with Pathfinder, because everybody I talk to loves Pathfinder, but my experience with it was so soured that I want to learn to play properly someday. Because if you don't have a good GM and you're not able to do the proper research, because I wasn't able to, I didn't know there were books for it online, and I didn't have any Pathfinder books that I could even borrow because other people were borrowing them. So I had no way to do research, and my GM wasn't really that available.
That is the nice thing about Pathfinder, is everything is open source. So there's a website, d20pfsrd.com. That SRD stands for Source Reference Documentation. It is literally the entire first party Pathfinder rule set. Everything from classes to game rules to items to archetypes, anything that was first party published by Paizo is there on that website.
And more than first party, there's third party stuff as well. I was shown the second Pathfinder game we started.
That stuff can be incredibly useful to just figure out, like, on the fly what you're doing. I recommend using it to learn how to play the game, because, like, that's like learning particle physics by reading the Wikipedia article. Like, it might be there, but you're not going to understand it that way. But it's just readily available there. As long as you've got an internet connection, you can just go to the source reference documentation, and everything you need for Pathfinder is just there and completely free. It's good stuff.
Which is good.
I wish more game systems would do that. Like, I know we talk all the time about how Tenra is my favorite thing, absolutely the ever. The unfortunate thing is Tenra isn't even part of the OGL, the Open Games License, wherein you can just kind of use the system in a public setting and, like, put the information about it out there. So, like, that's part of why you don't see Tenra on things like Roll20 and Rollgate and in Foundry and things, because, like, it's technically illegal to put Tenra on those things because of their copyright. It is owned by a Japanese company that did not submit the game to the US under the OGL. And I would like to see more games that would at least have that bare minimum there to put games out to be used in these third-party systems like Foundry or Roll20 or things, because those tools place everything you need there. Like, you don't have to necessarily have a monetary investment. You can kind of, in a risk-free way, play those games and figure things out about how the die rolls work, about how your player skills may work, about how enemy stat blocks work for GMs. That's something I love about Foundry, is just about everything you need for Pathfinder is in this huge compendium that you can just load into the game. And it takes about a billion years to load up the bestiary because of how many monsters are in that fucking thing. But I can look up anything I need about Pathfinder just in Foundry, and there it is. And that's so incredibly useful.
Nice. Yeah, and I would say having your game in these special things like Roll20 and Foundry might even convince people to, like, purchase the physical copies for when we are once again able to do in-person sessions. Because then you can share it, you know, off of, if you want to actually interact with people face-to-face again, you can. You don't have to pull out your computer or laptop or phone. You have the books. Boom, there they are.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people who just loves having the physical merchandise anyway. I love holding a book in my hand. I'm a nerd for that kind of thing. Not everyone is, and that's fine. Get that information any way you can. Just learn. If you enjoy a system, learn about it. Learn how to play it. Learn about your class. Learn about your race. Especially since there's so much lore in these things. Like, one of my favorite things about Pathfinder, I used to not like playing elves at all. Like, elves kind of seem like, oh, they're hoity-toity. Well, whatever, I don't like elves. Elves are stupid. I prefer dwarves. And I still prefer dwarves. Dwarves are fucking rad. We did a whole episode on dwarves. But whenever I did just a random rolled character and it came up playing an elf, and I looked into, like, what the fact that he was an orphan from birth would mean for him and growing up in a human society as opposed to an elven one, and how, like, most elves that don't grow up amongst other elves are horribly depressed because They're growing up and staying youthful while everyone around them is dying of old age. And they feel just completely disconnected from the rest of society. And that came into like being the character Myla Cien was just kind of a jackass. He didn't really connect with anybody. He thought he treated everything as a joke because that was his way of dealing with things. Is everything's a joke. He never really connects with anything on too deep of a level. Everything passes. So let's just laugh it off. But it made him very like aloof and unapproachable to a lot of people. And that was a fun thing to learn about elves.
Yeah, when I learned about the various races in Pathfinder, after I had done my first character, when I was working on my second character, I found out about fetchlings. I love fetchlings. I don't remember their actual name. I remember that, well, that is the actual name, but the name they prefer, because fetchling is a bad word to them. But I read and read and read on fetchlings because they fascinated me so much. So much so that I actually talked one another GM of mine into letting me find a homebrew D&D fetchling race so I could play them again, because I was sad that I didn't get to play that character. And they let me, and I was so happy.
So that's another reason to do your research, is to know what you like and how you can incorporate it in your games, how you can play that stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, we're coming up on just about, yeah, we're at 27 minutes now, so that'll be about our topic for today. So it's time. It's time to do the thing.
Roll that dice.
It's time to roll the magical D20. Yes. Are you ready for the ASMR of me fucking slamming this thing in my desk like always?
Yes.
It is number 13, the Kongoki of Tenra. Yes, one of my favorite things. Yay. I love the Kongoki.
Kongoki! That'll be fun.
So, that's what we will talk about next week. I would like to give a big old thank you to my Patreons, you Jenny, Mr. Word, Miss Ari, and Mr. Can. Thank you all so much for supporting the podcast.
You're welcome.
It means a lot to me. If you would like to also support the podcast, patreon.com/d20dudes. Not going to spoil too much, but I actually released a pilot for a little thing I'm going to be working on pretty soon.
It's awesome.
That's pretty fun. I had a good time making it. A lot of fun. If you want to reach out to us on the social medias, we are at d20dudes on Twitter, or you can find us at facebook.com on the d20dudes Facebook group. facebook.com/d20dudes. And if you would like to join our Discord, there is, of course, a link for that down in the description. As always, our Discord is open to everybody. Come say hi. We're sad and lonely, please.
Join us.
Cry if you don't.
Don't make him cry.
Anyways, we will catch you in next week's episode. Goodbye.
Bye-bye now.